So hello, everybody. We are back with Richard Rowland for one more episode of our Universal History. We've been talking about a lot of stuff in the past several months, some things that many people had never heard about, strange legends going to the ends of the earth with our series on Ethiopia. But now a lot of people will be excited because we're finally coming to talk about the Grail. And I know many people have been waiting for us to talk about the Grail just because it's such a prominent figure in Western legends, and there's so much around it, even up to today in popular culture. So I'm really happy to have Richard to talk about this because I know he's going to surprise me as well with some of his knowledge. And so, Richard, thanks for coming along.
I'm super excited to do this. The Grail is really important to me, and I think it's one of these great nexus points in the whole question of universal history. So I think that by the end of, you know, probably it's going to take us maybe a couple of videos to get through some of this Grail material. By the time we get through that, I think people will have a much better idea about, let's say, sort of the organic way that universal history kind of develops, and then it's actually kind of this ongoing process.
Right.
This is Jonathan Peugeot. Welcome to the symbolic world.
So before we start, though, I have a little personal thing going on, which is that Richard is one of the first people to actually read a copy of God's Dog, as many people know. At the end of October, probably when this is coming out, the crowdfunding will have already started for our graphic novel. And so I wanted Richard to say a few things about what he thought about our graphic novel.
Well, first of all, you owe me an afternoon because I had sat down. I was actually at a coffee shop working, and I had sat down. I was like, all right, I got this list of things, like I'm going to do some writing and some study and all this different stuff. And then as I'm in the middle of that, you message me and you're like, hey, do you want to look at God's Dog? And I was like, well, I guess that's the rest of my day. So, it's really cool. There are just the opening pages. There are so many things in them, which if people have been attentive, long-term viewers and listeners of your podcast, they're going to pick up on probably instantly. But I think the thing that's really impressive to me is the way that all of those symbolic elements, like they're not just like, oh, here's a neat symbolism thing, let's wedge this in, right? But they are really brought together in this very cohesive way, in this kind of medieval way of relating them to each other in such a way that we can sort of see how these concepts relate. I think there are probably very few people who are going to be really bothered by the freedom that you take with chronology. I say very few people because I think that kind of person probably isn't going to read your graphic novel
anyway.
But I also think it's maybe going to be a really great proof case for how a bunch of the things that we're talking about in universal history, in hagiography, in all these Christian legends, the lives of the saints. I mean, you've got St. George is in there, St. Christopher is in there, St. Simeon the Stylite is in there.
People who obviously didn't ever meet, right? Yeah.
But they're all sort of in there together. And of course, St. George is a really cool character. We're big St. George fans at my house. So there's that one sequence that I sent you a screenshot of, and I was like, this is really cool. And I had to come home and show that to my son, George, who's named after St.
Nice.
George.
Nice. Oh, I didn't know.
I don't know. It's going to be really great. I think it's going to do a lot of really important things. One of the things it's doing, and I know this is probably one of your main goals, is to return what should be, let's say, our native storytelling language. And you know that I am obviously a big Tolkien fan. I have a whole podcast about Tolkien. Right?
There's no doubt of your dedication.
So my Tolkien bona fides should not be
in question,
right? But I think part of the reason that Tolkien is so dominant when it comes to imaginative storytelling, especially in Christian spheres, to the point that most of us, if we're going to sit down and write a work of like fantasy fiction or something, I mean, Tom Shippey says, you have to spend the first few years just writing the Tolkien out of your system, right? But part of the reason that he's become so dominant is precisely that his books came along at a time when Christians had lost their native storytelling language. Like we become so disconnected from it that the only option that we really had was to make something like Middle Earth.
Right,
yeah. So I think that, and I'm not saying that's bad, obviously, again, I don't think anyone's going to question my love of Tolkien, but I do think that it's really important that we regain this, what should be for Christians, it should be our native language, right? And the thing is, like, once you do that, once you get really deep into something, then you go from having, you know, you enter into the glorious freedom of the sons of God, right? You go from having to be like just really rigidly strict with, okay, this chronology, and I'm going to write this incredibly, you know, like detailed historical novel, and maybe I don't believe these miracles and got to question all these things, right? You go from that approach to instead being able to, because you inhabit these things as like a native speaker of the language, you can then play with it with the kind of freedom that a native speaker of English has, right? A native speaker of English can do certain things with poetry that somebody who's learning English as a second language can't do or wouldn't understand. And I think you've accomplished that in this graphic novel. And I want to encourage everyone to please go and back it. I'm going to be getting multiple copies for gifts. I mean, Christmas is coming up soon. So I don't know if they'll fulfill before Christmas.
Probably not. Yeah,
probably not.
I wish it would,
I didn't,
but it's not.
I didn't promise for anything, Christmas. Just to be clear. But anyway, I'm going to be getting multiple copies as gifts, and I would encourage other people to do so as well. We want this book to do well so that we can have lots more things like this. So
yeah, thanks, Richard. I appreciate it. Yeah, the goal of this first crowdfunding is to kind of generate enough excitement and honestly enough money so that we can now put these out regularly, you know, like every 6 months or whatever, so we can get the whole story out. Because this is just the first chapter. It's just the beginning. The story is already totally written. It's very big. So we need a lot of room to tell it.
There's this great moment at the beginning of the graphic novel, if I can just share a little bit of, it's not really a spoiler, but where there's, you know, these pilgrims are walking along and they're singing this hymn. And I read the hymn and I messaged you and I said, which Syrian hymn is that? Like, I couldn't remember which one it was, but it was so obviously Syrian, you know, that it seemed like it had to be. And then you messaged back and it's, oh, it's this one. But it was really cool. So I'm jazzed about it.
Cool. All right, now on to the Grail. So let's start us off with the Grail.
So what I wanted to do for this first video on the Grail is to talk about what we could say the seeds or the sources are, the ground out of which the Grail legends, which are primarily explored through a genre of literature called a romance, not like, you know, people falling in love and getting married. Hopefully the people who watch your show are like astute enough to know what that term means, right? A romance basically just means like a high adventure story, right?
Yeah, because we've been talking about the Alexander romance, and so I'm sure they knew that wasn't a love story.
Right, yes. Now, actually, people, you know, do actually fall in love and get married in these stories, but yes, they're not just about that. So, okay. So I want to talk about three sources, and the first will be what I'll call the Celtic reliquary tradition. So those of you who are wanting like the symbolism of Ireland and things like that, you're not going to quite get that in this video, but you are going to get some of it. The second thing I want to talk about is let's call her the Iberian Virgin and her Grail. And then finally, I want to end on Joseph of Arimathea, who is, of course, very important to the Grail legends and his links to the Byzantine mystical tradition and sort of how all that comes in. So I'm not going to actually talk about the romances themselves today. And I think the reason for that will be sort of more apparent when we get to the end. So to begin with, in the Celtic tradition, the way that Celtic Christianity thought about and treated relics is a little bit different from what maybe, you know, other traditions have done. So in the Celtic tradition, it's there's a great deal of veneration given to the relics of the saints. This is nothing unusual in Christianity. What's unusual is that these relics don't always mean bones. In fact, they usually don't mean the bones of a saint. They usually seem to mean items that the relic that the saint has left behind them: liturgical books, gospels, croziers, bells, chalices, etc. And there, if you read Celtic hagiography, and I've been reading quite a lot of it lately, what you're going to find is a very unique honor and reverence that are given to these items that's different from what you find in the rest of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And there's some scholars who think that this is like a, let's say, a sanctification of the idea of the tribal palladium, you know, like the relics of, or the idols of the tribe or whatever that are sort of passed down in Celtic culture. That may or may not be the case. If it is the case, it's not a problem for us, right?
Yeah, but it's also there in scripture in terms of the passing of the skins of Elijah to Elisha. And then there's right. also the ark itself, which is this kind of physical object, which isn't the body of the saint, but which, let's say, gathers together a certain amount of authority or power with it.
Right. You know, right. And that's the thing to remember.
The ephod is, too, this idea of this ephod, right. which is transmitted, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah. That's the thing to remember about the ark is that it's a container. It held the tables of the law and the manna and Aaron's rod that budded and Goliath's sword. Weirdly enough, right? So that's, or at least at the very least, they kept Goliath's sword in the tabernacle, right? Mm-hmm. When David shows up there to get some food, he needs food and a weapon. And they said, well, the only food we have here is the showbread. And the only weapon we have here is Goliath's sword. So they had taken the sword of this Nephilim and they had actually kept it in the holy place in the tabernacle. So that's another video for another day. But all right, so the
flaming sword symbolism.
I know. So
basically, this Gaelic tradition of the importance of objects which right. are transmitted and which are can be connected to a saint. So
right, and so for instance, you had things like the Book of Saint Columba, which was born. They carried it out in battle, which is not unusual for relics in the Middle Ages. But the belief was that if a person who was pure of heart carried the book. Mm. Then it would bring victory for the clan. And of course, there are other relics that give oracles. One of the most important kinds of relics in the Celtic tradition is a bell, which is actually one of the forms that the Grail takes. We'll talk about that later, probably. Mm. The bell, and of course, what are bells used for in Western liturgy? They're used at the moment of the sacring, right? At the moment of the consecration of the gifts, that's, you know, a bell, there's a bell, it's called the sacring bell that is yeah. rung. They still do this in like some traditional Western liturgies. Yeah. So bells are very important. And the idea was, you know, and the miracles that are attributed to these relics, you know, they're oracles. There's, you know, bells that refuse to ring in the hand, except of the person for, you know, to whom it belongs, you know, like the saint, you know, so how do you know, like, is this saint legit or not, right? Is he really the one who's supposed to be our bishop? Well, the bell rings for him and not for anyone else. Mm-hmm. There's another bell that actually like sails through the air from Jerusalem to Wales, right? As a gift from heaven to this particular bishop. Some of the other items are really, really interesting. For instance, one of the most common forms that we find in Welsh and Irish hagiography is the idea of an altar, right? And we don't typically think of an altar as being a relic because we think of an altar as being like, you know, it's large, it's unwieldy, and it's more or less fixed to a certain place, right?
Yeah.
But in the Celtic tradition, there are all of these floating altars, flying altars, right? And I think this is somehow connected to the interconnectedness of, like, so the ancient Irish thought of the, let's say, mist. And of course, there's a lot of mist in that part of the world, right? They thought of it as still sort of being part of heaven. And so there was this idea that heaven and earth kind of became like, were a little more permeable at certain mm-hmm. places, right? And so this idea of the floating altar seems to be connected to this. So one that's actually really important to the Grail legend is the altar that was given to Saint David of Wales. This is, you know, the patron saint of Wales. And the story about him is that his birth was foretold to his father by an angel in a dream. And his father was supposed to go out hunting when he was going to find three things. He was going to find a stag, a fish, and a honeycomb. Each of these items are somehow foretelling or prophetic of Saint David's ministry. So for instance, the angel says that as the honey is in the wax, So he, that is David, will hold a spiritual sense in a historical instrument, which I just mentioned here because I think that's a great way to sort of describe symbolism or way to describe universal history, where you have these patterns that are above the historical, but now they're manifesting in historical ways. That was supposed to be what the life of the saint is. But there's also this fish, right? And this fish on which he was supposed to be fed. Now, I think most people know that the fish is an ancient symbol for Christianity. What people sometimes don't realize, especially like down here in Texas, pretty much every other car has like a little fish bumper sticker on it. What most of the people who have those bumper stickers don't probably understand is it's not just that the fish is a symbol for Christianity, but it's specifically a Eucharistic
symbol. Yeah, it's a symbol of the Eucharist.
Right. So you got all these, you know, evangelicals, God bless them, driving around with the symbol of the Eucharist on the back of their
Because it's the fish giving, in a way, it's like the gift, because the fish is giving itself to be eaten.
Yes.
Right? That's the mystery. It's like, that's why, like, or else why would you have a fish as a symbol for Christianity?
And it's also like the treasure that's drawn up out of death.
Yes, there's that,
like,
as well.
All these different things, right? There's another saint that's really wonderful. His name is Ilar, which is the same name as Hilary, but it's not Hilary of Poitiers. It's a different Ilar. And Ilar was just found. He was a foundling. He was found on the stone in the middle of a river. So they took him, and they came, you know, the monks that found him took him. They came back the next day, and on that stone in the middle of the river, there was just a fish. So they took that and they fed the child with the fish, and they came back every day. And every day for his whole childhood, there was the fish, and that's what they fed him with. And then he grew up to be this, you know, awesome wonder-working saint, and he could talk to animals and all this stuff, right? I mean, I love
all the best things. Stuff of
Celtic. Oh man, I just love this stuff just enormously, right? Yeah. And so, of course,
we're talking about the floating altars,
right? Yeah. So I'm just mentioning the fish thing because the fish and the floating altars seem to be connected, and there's of course this really important figure in the later Grail stories, the rich fisherman or the fisher king, right? Who's going to become really important to the story of the Grail. So just sort of like, you know, put a pin in that.
I'm interested to hear your opinion on that, because as a French person, I always see it as the sinner king. Like, that's how I see it. But
oh, interesting. Yeah, we can talk about that. Yeah. So in the earliest romances, we see the ancestor of the Grail keepers is he's made to catch this miraculous fish. And that's what gives him this title that's passed down. And yeah, we can talk a little bit more about that. But I want to note here that among Welsh saints and among Celtic saints, This idea, there's a connection to fishing and to fish that seems to crop up over and over again. Now, I mention all of this because the possession of these relics of the saints, altars, bells, chalices, croziers, gospel books, etc., the possession of these relics is a really important theme. So especially in Welsh Christianity, when Cadwallader, that is sort of like the last great Welsh king, when he dies in battle, it's prophesied that he will return. Obviously, this is what happens, right? It's prophesied that he will return when all of the ancient relics of the Welsh Church are revealed, when they're uncovered, when they manifest again. So it's like, and the idea is, it's not that we've totally lost them, but they're in hiding right now. You know, so there's this idea that you have these families, you know, very much like what's going on with the Ark in Ethiopia, okay, but obviously more obscure. There's this idea that you have this handed down tradition of the relics of one saint to somebody in their lineage, and that the person who has inherited them also inherits, you know, like that cloak of Elijah that you mentioned, also inherits some degree of their grace.
Yeah.
So I mention all of this to say that in the Celtic tradition, and this is picked up in one of the later romances called The High History of the Holy Grail, the Grail doesn't have one form. The Grail has five forms. And it is strongly implied that these forms, at least one of these forms, is a bell, a sacred bell. We're not told what all of the forms are, though. And the reason we're not told what all of the forms are, I'll read this again in our next video. The reason we're not told what all of the forms are is that it says it's not good to speak too explicitly of the sacraments. So when Arthur goes into the Chapel of the Grail and he actually sees the Grail in this particular version of the story, he sees it in the context of the Mass, of the liturgy. And the five forms of the Grail are revealed to him, and we're told the final form is the chalice, but we're not told what the other four are. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a strong implication that at least one of them is the bell.
Is a bell.
No.
Interesting. I want to say something a little bit about the idea of the relic and the power, just to, because one of the things you mentioned, I think it's important for people to see the connection, is that when you believe in a world where symbolism happens, let's say, there's a sense in which, you know, you talked about how if someone carries the book of St. Columba and has a pure heart, then the relic will be effective. That is, the relic will become a vehicle, you know, a connection between the two. And so there's a sense in which this is something which I think would have been implicitly understood in the different legends of these relics and goes into the Grail, which is that the only knight that can find the Grail, that can reach the Grail, has to have a pure heart. So there's actually a notion, the fact that you receive it is almost like a proof that you're right, of pure heart, right? There's a connection where it's just because you have a pure heart, you have access to this, but then having it becomes a proof of the fact that you also have a pure heart. And so there's a incarnational way of seeing the world where it's not like there isn't this arbitrary capacity. I say this because I was telling Richard recently that I watched the movie Constantine again, where you have this arbitrary idea that if you can get this relic, you know, if you can get this object, then you're going to have a certain power that you can then use. And it's almost like finding a grenade or finding a bomb. It's completely arbitrary. It has nothing to do with virtue. It's like Harry Potter style magic where you just have to like technically be proficient and learn these spells in the right way and know how to use these things almost like mechanical tools. But that is not the way in which ancient people thought. There was a deep connection between a virtue and, let's say, the power that the objects could have. And also kind of Christian faith and all of this and the manner in which objects could manifest or have power in the world.
So all of this, it's important to remember because the relic is always it's not just that the relic has like the powers of the virtues of the saint, right? This is God's power, right? It's God's grace. We would say his energies. It's something that's constantly given to us as a gift. Right. And so, yeah, it's not this mechanical thing. And that's part of why we have to be really careful about how we talk about this stuff. And that's why there would be a certain amount of secrecy about, even just like a saint whose relics we have. Right. We don't parade them around the streets, exposing the mystery. Right. At the very least, we're going to have it in the name of the church. Some relics or, especially holy icons, things like this, we might bring out on certain feast days, right? There would be a time when the mystery is revealed, but we don't, it's not this mechanical thing. I was literally just arguing with somebody about that on Discord before this video started. I said, every time you say the word magical system, a fairy dies. I cannot stand systematized magic in fantasy fiction.
Yeah.
I want to mention one thing, because this will be really important for talking about the Grail later on, but also you're going to get just a tremendous kick out of it being who you are. Okay. So Saint David is given this altar, right? And so this happens when he is on, his pilgrimage to Jerusalem, we're told that as God gave Matthias in Judea, Christ in Jerusalem, and Peter in Rome, so he has given Saint David to be in the island of Britain. So the idea that Saint David was sort of like the keeper of like the apostolic lineage in the island of Britain. And this is a long time like before the Joseph of Arimathea stuff and all this, right? And we're told that the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who's the one consecrating David as bishop, gives him one of these altars. It says a certain hallowed altar in which the Lord's body had reposed. And this seems to be connected to that stone. There's that stone in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I can't remember the name right now. That stone on which Christ's body was laid after he was brought down off the cross. And that whole, all the legends and the stories surrounding what happens to Christ's body when it's brought down off the cross are going to be essential to understanding where the Grail comes from. So we're told that he's given this hallowed altar in which the Lord's body had reposed, which abounded in innumerable virtues. And then we're told, never was this altar seen after the death of the bishop, St. David, by any son of man, but it lies hidden, covered with skins.
What?
I know, right?
Strange legend.
Yeah. And so, and it says, hence the common people call it the gift from heaven. Huh. So as we talk about the, and I knew you would love the fact that it's covered in skins.
Oh, yeah.
What else would you cover it in? But there's also another saint actually in the same book, Saint Karanak, to whom we're told that Christ gave an honorable altar from heaven, the color of which no person can comprehend. But this altar is also wrapped in skins most of the time. So it's like this jeweled altar that's like a color that no one on earth has ever seen, but it's it's kept veiled, right? Mm. So I'm going to mention, I mentioned this because the key idea of the Grail isn't really just a chalice, right? Obviously, that becomes the most enduring image for kind of obvious reasons. In some senses, it's because it's the best image, right? But the idea of the Grail is really something which is hidden, which contains or has contained the body and the blood of Christ, right? So there's this altar which had somehow contained the Lord's body. It's not elaborated on because it's in Jerusalem. There does seem to be a connection to this stone on which Christ's body was laid. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind that most of the Grail legends start popping up in Western Europe during the time of the Crusades. So people are coming from the East and they're bringing back these tales of like amazing relics that they've seen or like heard legends about. But that's the key idea of the Grail. So we're told, for instance, like I mentioned, the high history of the Grail has these five forms, only the last of which is the chalice. Mm-hmm. It's going to be much later. We'll talk about this in our next video when Robert de Boron, he has the Grail become the cup of the Last Supper.
Right.
But that's sort of the final form. You could say that's the final form that the Grail takes in the romances. Like once it takes that form, the Grail is always that in all the future retellings of the story.
Yeah, for sure. Because in Chrétien, it's not clear that that's what's going on, right? When he sees
it's not, that idea is not at all there in Chrétien.
It's for sure a vessel.
It's for sure a Eucharistic vessel.
Yeah.
That's it. And we'll talk more about where that connection comes in a little bit. So you have this idea of like the altar, which is kind of like the ultimate version of this in the Celtic tradition, this hidden altar that comes from heaven, that's contained God's body, and which is now covered over, it's veiled, it's covered in these garments of skin. Okay. So that's kind of the first thread in what eventually becomes the Grail story. The second one we could talk about is in the what I've called the Iberian Virgin and her Grail. And if you want to know more about this, by the way, I know people love, like, where can I go read about this myself? This is a great book called The Virgin and the Grail by Joseph Gehring. And it's all about this image. So the image that you see manifesting in, let's say, in the Pyrenees, right around the time of between the third and the fourth and a little bit after the Fourth Crusade, right? You have these images that come up over and over again, these beautiful Romanesque frescoes. I mean, they're really stunning. Whenever somebody's like, I'd like to see more Western art in churches or something like that, I'm like, well, I would too, but I don't think we mean the same thing by that. I think you mean like Renaissance stuff, and I mean this stuff. Like this is like amazing stuff, and very like, it's very sort of distinctly Western, but also really consonant with the Byzantine tradition. And so the first image of this seems to be, and this isn't it's by an anonymous painter, fresco. Do you call somebody who paints frescoes like a painter, or they are a fresco? I don't know. Anyway, he's called the Master of St. Clement because we don't know who he was. People didn't sign their work. But he was a really gifted iconographer. And in the apse of this church, the St. Clement of St. Clement's of Toll in the Pyrenees Mountains, you have this image of Christ in glory surrounded by the four creatures. And I mean, it's very, very Byzantine image. If you've ever been to an Orthodox church, you've seen this somewhere, you'll immediately recognize it. But then beneath him, around around the base of the apse of the church, you see the choir of the apostles, right? So the 12 apostles plus some. But then in their center, and sort of standing as like the first among equals among them, is the Mother of God. And the Mother of God is standing there, and she's holding, you can kind of see it in the cover art right here, because this is
she's holding a cup of some kind.
She's holding it's a dish. Yeah, so the word Grail means it means like a large shallow serving dish, and actually specifically it's a serving dish for serving fish. That's what you serve in a Grail. And this is in Chrétien, it says the Virgin, he sees this Virgin coming in holding this large Grail in which you might serve like a pike or a lamprey, in other words, like a very large fish. So again, thinking about Fishier, carrying.
Right. This idea of a container for food, a container for fish, an altar or an altar, or like a tombstone, all of these images of these containers, but that are also, yeah, that are also secret, that are heavenly. All of this is kind of coming together.
Right. Already. So there's something about this. And this original image seems to be of the Ascension. I should have prefaced that by saying this original image seems to have been of the Ascension. So in the Byzantine tradition, right, when we portray the Ascension, it's essentially exactly like this. We show Christ in glory. He's being taken up to heaven on the cherubic throne. And then beneath him, we have all of the apostles. And in the midst of the apostles, we have the Mother of God. And she's flanked on either side, right, by two angels. You've done some really great videos. It's been a while, but you've done some really great videos about this icon of the Ascension, right, which is an icon of the church, what the church was at that moment, what it is now, and of course, the way that we expect.
Yeah, and it's an eschatological vision as well. It's also how, because it says even in scripture that Christ will return in the same manner that he left. Yeah.
So this seems to be a reworking of the Byzantine image of the Ascension. But what's different about it, and this is the crucial difference, and this is about 50 years before Chrétien wrote his Grail story, which is the first real Grail romance, right? So 50 years before that, this guy painted this image and he shows the Virgin Mary holding in her hand this grail. And in the grail, there are flames shooting up out of it. So it's not totally sure what's in the grail. The author of this book has some theories. I don't think they're all totally right, because there's some things. I mean, he's writing about Christian ritual from an outsider perspective, whereas anybody who's lived in the church and been to liturgy enough times and things like this, but on the whole, I think he's right in that he says that the contents of the bowl are either, it's either the Eucharist or it's chrism. And that for our purposes, it doesn't really matter which one of those it is, right? That in other words, this fiery bowl, right? Contains, let's say it shows the way in which the grace of the Holy Spirit has been given to the church, which the creator of this fresco saw as being mediated through the incarnational experience of the church, which we understand through the Mother of God.
So this author, does he see this as a kind of small image of Pentecost?
Yes.
While being an image of the Ascension.
He doesn't talk about Pentecost so much. He does talk about it a little bit. Again, that's where I think,
because in the Western tradition, by the way, the image of Pentecost resembles the image of Ascension. Right. We have this image where we don't have a character in the center. And it's like these chairs going around like this in the door. But the Western version, and the one in the Rabula Gospels, which is one of the earliest versions of Pentecost, we see the disciples in a line with the Mother of God in the center, and then the fire coming down upon them all. So it's closer to the image of the Ascension that you would find normally.
I didn't know that. I did know that in Armenian depictions of the Ascension is very often the same. So that, where you do have the Mother of God there. And I actually have seen some Byzantine icons that have her there. Not the one that's in our church, but in my home parish, but I have seen that a few times. So
yeah, it's a very old tradition. People say people don't like it because it's not the one we ended up with. But the idea, it's a very, very old tradition to have the Mother of God in the center.
So this is a little aside, but once my daughter for an art class decided that she wanted to do an icon of Pentecost, and she was just doing it totally from memory, having grown up in the church and things. And she just, even though the fresco that we have on the ceiling of our church, it's right on the other side of the apse, on the other side of the iconostasis from the apse, we have a very traditional Pentecost icon, nobody seated in the middle. And that's that's the icon that she's seen in her entire growing up. But when she did the icon, she put the Mother of God right in the middle. It was just a normal, here's Mary, here's baby Jesus, here's the church around them. And so that's really interesting.
If anybody's interested, by the way, I wrote an article specifically about that.
Cool.
On the two women, on the two images of the church, let's say the church of the Jews and the church of the Gentiles, or the inner woman and the outer woman, and so how it's related to Pentecost, to Ascension and Pentecost. So I'll put a link of that in the description for
people. Yeah, that'd be great. Right after this image, what we see then happening in churches all across, let's say the certain region of Spain, is and then into France, we see this image of, and it very quickly changes into just Mary holding a chalice. Mm-hmm. But we show this image popping up in Romanesque iconography from the century again and again and again. And it's worth noting that the romancers who wrote down their versions of the Grail stories, that their patrons, their original patrons, were these troubadour crusader kings and lords who originally came from this region. Mm-hmm. Right. So that they're coming east, they're going east for the Crusades, they're coming back. This iconography pops up, and then about 50 to 100 years later, that's when all of the Grail romances start showing up in Western Europe. So I find this very interesting. Of course, it is in Chrétien, it is the virgin, it is a virgin, maybe not the virgin, but it is a virgin who is carrying the Grail in the procession in the Fisher King's palace. Okay. So the third seed of the Grail story, and this is where things get a little weird. The third seed.
You don't think slaying altars is weird enough?
I mean,
we need much weirder stuff.
I mean, yeah. Okay, so we have this icon of we call it like the Holy Mandilion or the icon made without hands, right? If you've been to an Orthodox church, you've probably seen this icon, right? It's weird because it's like an icon of a towel with the face of Jesus on it, right? And this goes back to this legend, which is, let's say, attested in some of our earliest Christian historical sources, right? So much so that, you know, I personally, it's a feast of the church. I take for granted that it's a real thing that happened, right? I have no reason to doubt it, right? But this legend that essentially there was King Abgar of Edessa, right, who had desired an icon of Christ. And so he sent his people to make a copy of Christ's face, like to make a picture of him,
a painting,
right? Or to get something of Christ. And, you know, Abgar is sick. And in some versions of the story, he's sick with leprosy. But actually, very importantly, in other versions of the story, especially in the Middle Ages, as the legend gets sort of elaborated, he's paralyzed. Mm-hmm. In other words, of course, paralysis is also always sort of associated with, let's say, infertility and all these things, right? So you have a paralyzed king, a wounded king, right? Mm. And so he sends for something of the Lord's, which will be able to heal him. And basically what happens when the people, they come to draw Christ, is that they can't do it. Like they're actually not able to depict him. They can't get his image. Actually, in one of the, so remember what I said about the Grail having five forms, right? In one of the versions of the story in the Middle Ages, the reason they can't get his image is because as they start trying to draw him, his image constantly changes. And it goes from being a little child to being a 30-year-old man to being Christ in his passion to being the Ancient of Days, right? And it moves through these, like, all these different things, right? And they can't do it. So finally, Christ basically makes them an icon. It's at least of his face, but possibly of his entire body.
Yeah. So he imprints his right. form onto the cloth.
Right. And so he gives that to them, and they take it back to the city of Edessa. And there are all kinds of, this is, people don't understand now. Like we understand a little bit in like the Orthodox Church, because like, again, we have this icon in a lot of places, and we do have a feast for it. It's one of the three feasts of the Lord in the month of August. But this is a big deal in the Middle Ages. People copied and recopied and copied and recopied the story. Many of the Crusaders who, obviously Edessa was taken by the Western Crusaders and during the First Crusade, it was retaken. And then in the Fourth Crusade, of course, Constantinople was sacked. By the time of the Fourth Crusade, the icon of the Holy Face, the Holy Mandilion, was in Constantinople at Blachernae. And if you go back and you read the firsthand eyewitness accounts of the people who saw this icon, but then you also, if you read the legend, so there were legends that got copied into Latin from a pretty early date, that a lot of these crusaders brought back west with them. Mm-hmm. And you start looking at, let's say, the theological connection between, or not the theological connection, but you start looking at the connection between the things that are supposed to happen in the Grail Chapel or in the Grail Palace, right? Or the Grail Castle. If you look at those, and then you look at the rituals that were associated with the veneration of this icon, mm-hmm. in Edessa and then in Constantinople later, they map, mm-hmm. very tightly. Okay. And of course, there's a lot of other stuff. Obviously, the spear is, the Holy Spear, the Lance of Longinus, whose feast day was in the Orthodox Church, was just a few days ago, by the way, from when we're recording this. That comes up during the time of the Crusades, right? Because it's uncovered, or it's believed to be uncovered during the Siege of Antioch, and all this other stuff is going on, right? So all of the stuff is kind of coming west. And in particular, and I don't totally understand, because obviously there's the, you have basically like three versions of this idea of like a cloth that has Christ's face on it, right? You have the Shroud of Turin or the burial shroud. You have the like the cloth that St. Veronica is supposed to have pressed against Christ's face, came away with that impression of the icon. And then you have this, the Holy Mandilion, the icon made without hands. Yeah. But in a lot of these earlier stories, those all basically seem to be the same thing.
Well, for sure, they all seem to, at least the earliest one is the Mandilion tradition.
Yes.
Like that's very old.
So this is where it gets a little kind of mind-blowing. And I don't even know how much I want to say about this, but in the earliest descriptions that we have of people who went to venerate the Mandilion and wrote about it, so these are firsthand eyewitness accounts, it's not just the face.
Okay.
That it's actually a cloth that has been folded. But if you unfold the entire thing, it would give you this impression of Christ's body, at least from like the waist up. And that this impression was made with Christ's sweat and with his blood.
So but it's more like the Turin, the shroud.
Yeah, yeah. So, but typically speaking, what they would do is that this whole thing would be folded up. In fact, one of the names for the cloth means like the cloth that's been folded 8 times or something like this. And they would fold the cloth up so that only the face could be seen. And you could only see the face. I mean, it's heavily protected. So you could only see the face if you look through the certain aperture, which you're only allowed to do at sort of certain times, right? And so it's, again, it's this idea of here's something that contains Christ's body, that contains Christ's blood, right? Or at least the impression of them.
Yeah. Well, it's a container for Christ's body, just like the tomb, just like, yeah.
Right. And so all of this is tied then with the Byzantine apocryphal tradition surrounding Joseph of Arimathea. So Joseph of Arimathea, who was put into prison and released after the Emperor Vespasian was healed by the holy cloth of leprosy. You know, this is the legend that's found in the Gospel of Nicodemus and the Acts of Pilate, these two apocryphal works that are really important in our tradition.
Yeah.
When I say they're apocryphal, I don't mean that we totally discount them. I think maybe by now people know that, but that is
the source of the source of the Anastasis icon is from the Gospel.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So obviously a really important part of our tradition.
So Joseph takes the blood, or he takes the cup, or he carries it.
So he's closely associated originally with his burial cloth, especially in the rituals surrounding its veneration at Edessa, or burial cloth, or the Mandilion, or whatever you want to call it. He's very closely associated with that in the tradition of the city of Edessa. Now, the other place where this comes in would be two things. One is that during the first, especially the first millennia of the church, going into like the 13th and 14th century, there's a really rich tradition of Byzantine, Eastern Christian mystagogical commentaries on the liturgy, right? You could basically say it's like doing allegorical commentary on the liturgy, except that nobody knows what allegory means anymore. And so I don't like to use it, that word, because people get confused. But it's ways of sort of, let's say, interpreting and explicating the mystery of the divine liturgy. And of course, the most important one of these is probably St. Maximus the Confessor's mystical, ecclesial mystagogy, which I've talked about a lot, and I'm a big fan of that particular work. One of the things I love about it is that I only understand maybe like a fourth of it. Because he's like, the liturgy has these four or five senses, and he explains the first sense, and I'm like, okay, I get that. He explains the second sense, and I'm like, okay, I get that. And then he starts explaining like the third, fourth, fifth senses, and I'm like, I don't even like my I'm such a baby, you know, spiritually, like I have no idea what that's even about, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But basically in these commentaries, what we get is this idea. So you find this in like St. Germanus's commentary, this idea that there is a, let's say, like a polyvalence or an overlapping sense of meaning between the chalice or the patens, the epitaphion, you know, like the cloth that has, which is exactly cloth this,
which is an image of the shroud, basically.
Right.
It's an image that has the body of Christ stitched or painted on it, and that which is on the altar.
Right. So between that, between the patens and the, and actually the epitaphion seems to have developed, and I'm sure there are people out there who know way more about liturgical history than I do, but it seems to have developed originally from the veil, which is placed over the chalice and over the patens. Mm-hmm. So those seem to be related, which, you know, okay, all intuitively, like on a symbolic level, all that stuff makes sense, right? So there's a relationship between these things and then the deacon who carries them out during the liturgy, mm-hmm. right? And such that we are told, and this is in a Byzantine liturgical commentary, which is then translated into Latin, which then is like reworked into another Latin commentary on the Latin Mass. And like there's three or four levels of this, versions of this, that come to the West right about the time that all the Grail legends are popping up, in which we are told that the deacon at this moment is imaging the role of Joseph of Arimathea.
Really?
So this stuff is like deeply, and of course, I mean.
Well, I mean, I guess because he carried, you could say it really immediately because he carried the body down and he put the body in a tomb.
And think about how heavily Joseph of Arimathea features in the Eastern liturgy, right? That long, beautiful, the noble Joseph Triparion that we sing every year. We sing it during Holy Week. We sing it again on the Sunday of the Myrrh Bearers, right? The role that he had in taking the body of Christ down and sort of carrying it. He's so closely connected in the Eastern liturgical tradition, not just in like the Byzantine version that's come down to us in our church, but also like in the Syrian tradition. Mm-hmm. He's so closely connected to the act of carrying the body of Christ that that's the connection that these liturgical, like these mystical commentaries on the Mass and on the Divine Liturgy, that's the connection that they make.
Yeah, and so because also Joseph offers the vessel.
Yes.
Like he actually offers the tomb, like he pays for it, right? He buys the tomb. And so he offers this vessel for the body. And so it's like, it all makes sense, like in a very immediate way, notwithstanding all the legends, which are going to come later.
Right. So the legends about like Joseph coming to England and all this stuff that comes much later.
Okay.
Comes much later, right?
They make so much sense, like with all this symbolism, right? We know what England is.
Right. So that's the thing though, is one of the things I want to point to with something like the Grail Legends, where you have a story that is clearly non-historical, let's say, but also so fundamentally true that we keep trying to tell it over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. Like the Holy Grail, as far as I'm concerned, the Holy Grail is like the great story of Western civilization. Like it's the big problem. The fact that in the early stories of the Grail, I'll talk more about this in the next video, but in the early stories of the Veil, the Grail, the Grail quest is achieved. But the more we retell it and the longer it goes, the more unattainable the Grail becomes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's really, really telling.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but it also has to do, like, if you understand what's going on when the Grail legends are appearing and you notice that, you know, there's the idea that there's a mystery which is no longer accessible. To me, this is something that, especially as an Orthodox person, I can see as related to one of the problems which comes in the late Middle Ages as this nominalism gets set in, as certain branches of, so it's almost as if mythically there's an intuition that there's something off and that there's something that we used to have access to or that we should have access to that we don't anymore. Like there's an aspect of the mystery which has been kind of, that has been kind of pulled away from us. And so it's related to the schism. I think so.
Yeah. So this is where I'm going to get myself into a little bit. You shouldn't say these things so that I can be the one that gets in trouble with some of your listeners. Okay. but there are a lot of serious Grail scholars out there who have pointed out the fact that the Grail legend begins to arise in Western Europe exactly at the time that people start arguing about transubstantiation, mm-hmm. right? Right at the time that Berengarius and all these people, they're like, is it a symbol? Is it what? Is it this? Is it that? Right? Just right at the point that, and of course, that's where somebody like Alexander Schmemann sort of points the original, that's where maybe things start to go wrong. You know, everyone's got maybe their date for when things start to go wrong, but what everybody agrees with on is that something obviously went wrong, right? But right at the time that the secularism begins to be born, and that rift in Western sacramental theology starts to slowly widen in what's eventually going to become the Reformation and all the things that kind of are downstream from that. Right at the time that was happening is when the Grail story starts to manifest itself in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. The idea of the unattainable Grail culminates right around the time of the Fourth Crusade, which is kind of the death knell in any hopes of reunion between the Eastern and Western Church. Mm. I think, you know, my reading, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this, is that historically people still thought they were going to be able to get the band back together.
Yeah.
Right until, you know, Latin crusaders sacked Constantinople and they put a prostitute on the throne of the Patriarch of Constantinople in the Church of Hagia Sophia. And at that point, they were like,
This is not happening anymore.
Maybe this is not going to work out after all, right? So, and I think you're right. Like, I think it's connected to those things. And it's part of what makes the story of the Grail so important and also so tragically painful. What I want to do in the next video is to start going through some of the romances of the Grail.
Yeah.
And I want to start with Chrétien, because even though his version is not, let's say, the definitive version, I think in some ways it's still the best.
Yeah.
And I think that actually people have been reading it profoundly wrong for a very long time, that everyone thinks it's unfinished and everyone thinks Percival doesn't get the Grail. And I think that's totally wrong.
Oh, right.
So just tease that for next video.
My last words are going to be something like, even now in the discussion that we've had talking about the sources of where the Grail legend comes from, we notice that there is something about the Grail itself, which is related to the West, that has to do with the West. If we understand the West in the sense of the place where the sun sets, that Western edge of the world. And we always have to remember, now we live in America. And so this has kind of been thrown up. There's been a stretching out of the West, you could say. But for the ancients, Britain was the edge of the world, right? It represented that Western edge of reality, where the barbarians were still there and it was still kind of a wild land that had to be tamed. You know, we remember that the giants were there. There's all these stories about what it is that Britain represents. So there's a sense in which all these stories are kind of coming together and manifesting the West and manifesting this notion of the container and the support for something sacred, something which holds the sacred in it, the altar, the cup, the chalice, the Grail, the cloth, all of these are all these supports. And it's also a book. There's also a version of the Grail myth legend, which it's a book. So it's all these idea of the support of something from above, right? And so it is, of course, related to the feminine. And so we can already see that why so much of the madness of the Grail stories that have come to us recently, and Dan Brown, I'm talking to you in this statement, is they've wanted to make it about, right, they all wanted to make it about the feminine, and they're totally right that it is about this, about the feminine. But we also need to understand it rather as something which is pointing beyond the kind of crass way in which people like Dan Brown have wanted to bring about, like as if all these mysteries, all these stories, what they're pointing to is some historical fact that everybody wants to hide, and that's it. There's no more meaning to it than that. It's all about hiding something that happened that nobody wants you to find out about. Yeah. And so that's really like, if it was that, then should just all throw it in the trash anyways, because it's not really interesting.
So I think that the things you're saying are, so something that's really curious to me about this Grail stuff, right, is that essentially all of the pieces are there in the East, but the East never has a Grail story. They never have a Grail legend. They never have a Grail romance. And in general, the East never, they just never develop, let's say, imaginative literature to the same degree. Even like, you know, like the great Orthodox novels like Dostoevsky or something like that are, you know, they're like super, super like in your face and very like grounded and gritty and realistic and things like this. And it's not that we don't have like wonder tales or things, but when we have them, they tend to be in hagiography or in stories of miracles and things like this. And there's like a, like just this experience of a much more proximate experience of the divine, of the miraculous, of relics, of saints, of angels, of all these different things that is there initially in, say, like the age of the saints, like the fifth and sixth century, you know, Wales or somewhere like that. but starts to be lost in the West. And as that distance begins to stretch out, you have something very much like, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot because I write fiction. Obviously, I love talking about fiction, right? Fiction is the garment of skins in which St. David's altar is wrapped, mm-hmm. right? It's our inability to come to some of these things in like a really bald way, in like a really open way. We can't do it anymore. And I say this, you know, obviously I'm a practicing Christian. I'm a member of the Orthodox Church, but I'm also a Western person.
Yeah.
And that hasn't changed. And I'm like, I'm totally, as much as I can be, I try to be aware of what that means. And what, you know, obviously there's some great things about that. There's also some big limitations that I'm trying to work through. And I think that you could say the Grail romances, right? And the way that they develop precisely at this time that something is being lost, that there's a rift that's happening, and they become a way to take that thing that's being lost and sort of wrap it in this protective covering of skins, which becomes poetry and romance and all this stuff.
And a sense of nostalgia. There's a sense in the Grail of nostalgia.
Yeah, especially the later version, like Robert de Baron, this deep sense that, man, if we could have, I mean, this is all the way back in Chrétien, like in his romance, which is the first Grail romance, like that sense that if he could have asked the right question.
He could have asked what's the Grail.
Yeah, if he could have asked the right question, then he would, like, then the land would have been healed.
Yeah.
That in other words, communion would have been restored. Which I think actually, again, happens in that romance and people miss it. So we'll talk about
it. All right. Well, that'll be the way to end this, to see how is it that Richard thinks that Chrétien got it right. Well, I love Chrétien's romance. And so I'm really excited to find out about it. So everybody, thanks for your time. Thanks for your attention. Of course, this is just the beginning of our discussing the Grail. And so we're looking forward to the next episode. Having an announcement, go for it.
Go back God's dog.
Oh, and go back God's dog. All right, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Symbolic World. The Symbolic World is based on a series of videos that you can find on my YouTube channel, Jonathan Peugeot's YouTube channel. You can also get involved. There is a Facebook group that has started by fans of the podcast called The Symbolic World Within the Zombie Invasion. I will put a link to that in the show description. And so it is a discussion of all things symbolism that it's quite interesting. I'd like to drop in there and also leave some of my comments as well. You can always help the podcast by, of course, leaving a review on iTunes. Everybody knows that's the best way to get the podcast out there, to get it heard. And if you want to get involved, you can also support the podcast financially going to www.thesymbolicworld.com/support or else on Patreon, the Peugeot videos as well, and on Subscribestar. All those links you can find on my website or in the show description. So thank you, and I will see you soon.